Welcome to the Sustainable Nano Podcast. I'm your host, Miriam Kraus. In this episode, we're very fortunate to have for you an interview with Dr. Valerie Young, who's an expert in the phenomenon of imposter syndrome. You may have heard about this before. We will talk a lot about what exactly it is and what it means. Dr. Young is the author of several books, including The Secret Thoughts of Successful Women. We talk a little bit about how that title doesn't actually cover all of the issues with imposter syndrome, because of course men can suffer from it too. She came to the University of Minnesota last semester to do a talk that was coordinated by the chemistry chapter of the Women in Science and Engineering group here at the university, and she was generous enough to sit down with Sustainable Nano for an interview while she was here for that visit. So without further ado, here's our interview with Dr. Young. Thank you so much for coming. Welcome to the Sustainable Nano podcast. Do you want to introduce yourself briefly?
Sure, absolutely. I'm Valerie Young, and I've been speaking and writing and experiencing something called the imposter syndrome for probably 3 or 4 decades now.
Yeah, I wanted to jump right in then and ask you to tell our listeners, if they're not familiar with it, what is imposter syndrome and, you know, how is it different from just, you know, low self-confidence, for example, which is sometimes what it can sound like on a superficial level.
Right, right. Yeah, most often people, Miriam, think it's a fancy term for low self-esteem. I think self-esteem is kind of a global sense we have about ourselves, but imposter feelings are very specific to achievement arenas, to work, academics, career, business. You know, you don't feel like an imposter when you're walking your dog or doing the laundry. And basically what it describes is an experience whereby, despite evidence to the contrary, it could be good grades, getting into school, degrees, awards, letters of recommendation from faculty, grants, tenure, promotions. People have a really hard time really internalizing and owning those accomplishments. And instead, they attribute them to outside factors like luck, timing, ease, supposed ease of the task. I actually heard a guy say, if I can get a PhD in astrophysics from Caltech, anybody can.
That's a great example. So how do we balance that between sort of a healthy sense of humility or awareness that there are factors outside our control? Sometimes luck can play a role in things. So how do you kind of frame imposter syndrome as like, no, this really is an unrealistic perspective that afflicts people?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We want to have healthy humility, and we'll call them non-imposters and imposters for the sake of the conversation. But non-imposters understand that luck does play a role. You know, timing can play a role. Connections, personality, you know, all these things that we go, oh, it's just because they like me, you know, or someone helped me get the job. And what I want people to understand is all of those things may indeed be true. It's what you do with that luck that makes all the difference. And certainly no one's going to recommend you for something and put their reputation on the line if they don't think you're up to the challenge. So I think it's important that we understand that all of these things have a legitimate role in everyone's success to one degree or another, and not see them as a explaining away or diminishing somehow from our success.
Mm-hmm. So how does imposter syndrome affect people? What's the downside other than just kind of making you feel bad?
Yeah, the downside is when you feel like an imposter, it's stressful. And let me be clear, we don't feel this way 24/7, right? There's moments where these feelings come up when you're going to go in and talk to your advisor, when you're perhaps submitting a grant, when you're asked to make a presentation, you're sitting in class and you're called on, or you're thinking about raising your hand, or certainly interviews would be a prime opportunity to feel like an imposter. So it is stressful in those moments. And so being human, you know, there's some part of us unconsciously that is trying to manage the anxiety of waiting to be found out and of feeling like an imposter. So we do things like Dr. Pauline Clance and Dr. Suzanne Imes, the two psychologists who coined the term the imposter phenomena. They talked about coping and protecting strategies. So it would be things like flying under the radar, right? If you keep a low profile, you don't challenge yourself, you don't speak up, you don't go after more rigorous opportunities, then you're safer, right? They can't hurt you or judge you if you play small. For other people, it might be procrastination. I always tell people when I was supposed to be writing my dissertation, I had the cleanest house in Northampton, Massachusetts. And how procrastination protects us, I'm going to be clear, we all procrastinate. I mean, that's just life, right? But where it matters is, you know, around your research or job kinds of things where the outcome really is very important. And procrastination becomes kind of a sabotage technique. So the example I like to use, Miriam, is years ago, there was a young political science major who really wanted this coveted internship in Washington. to get it, she had to write a major heady essay, and she had 6 months to do it, but it was not a lightweight kind of thing. So it's due June 15th. Of course, she starts it June 14th, gets it in overnight mail. She got it in on time. She didn't get the internship. But here's how you then frame it. You go, well, you know, I'm disappointed, but I'm hardly surprised because it didn't represent my best effort. The rub is, if she had gotten it, she probably wouldn't have felt deserving. She would have felt like, you know, I fooled them again. And when I get to Washington, they're going to realize I just whipped that off and, you know, it's a bunch of crap. Workaholism is another one. Studying harder, staying longer than everyone else, not out of the requirements of the task, but out of the sense that I have to because I'm not as intelligent as other people. And then, of course, a famous one on campus would be either never starting or never finishing. And if something's always in progress, I'm still working on, you know, the degree, the painting, the book, the business plan. No one can judge you because it's still in progress. Yeah. And you can always kind of wonder, you know, well, if I wanted to, or if I, you know, I could have been a great whatever, but you never really tested yourself to find out.
Yeah, when you said painting and literature, obviously it applies beyond science. You know, we're a science podcast, so we're focusing on that topic. But I've heard in sort of artistic terms this phenomenon referred to as the fraud police, being afraid that someone's going to come knocking on your door and say, you're not a real artist, you know, when in fact, of course, that's not going to happen. And I guess the same could be said for scientists as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you're in a subjective field, which is being in a creative field like writing or acting, they are a more kind of susceptible group because you're being judged by very subjective standards by people whose job title is professional critic. Somebody actually said to me recently, someone kind of said to her, well, you're not a real artist, and kind of differentiated between crafts and art. And she feels like she's not an artist because she doesn't have a degree. And I said, well, imagine you go into a gallery and you look across the room and you see this painting that's like perfect for you. You want that painting so bad, you run over to it, but then you stop short and you go, wait a minute, I wonder if this artist has an MFA, right? It's like, you couldn't care less, right? I mean, art is art. Do your art.
Yeah, that's interesting. In science, there's more layers of formal accreditation where you do this training, and by doing that training, you're sort of officially certified as qualified to do XYZ or something.
But how that can play out in the sciences is people running around trying to get more and more credentialed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like one more book to read, one more class to take, one more degree to get.
You know, they're quote-unquote ready.
To start the dissertation or to be an expert, whatever that means.
Yep. Yeah. So that transitions into thinking again about, like, in the context of science, I was just reading through your website a little bit, and you mentioned the researcher Peggy McIntosh, who talks a lot about the situational element of imposter feelings, and you alluded to that, saying, you know, we don't feel it when we're walking our dog or doing the laundry or something. But I like you ended that blog post saying, the root cause of fraudulent feelings is the fraudulent roles we are asked to play as part of systems of achievement that are hierarchical and competitive. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that applies in the context of the world of scientific research and academia.
Right. Yeah, and Peggy McIntosh from Wellesley, that really was her whole thesis, that it really has to do with, you know, again, the fraudulent roles we're asked to play. And in many ways, we're all wearing a mask of some way or another. I mean, I think there's some other core reasons for imposter syndrome, but that's another one to look at, especially in academia. I mean, academic culture in and of itself, which is different than business culture or nonprofit or medical or arts, is its own unique thing. And academic culture in and of itself can fuel self-doubt in students, but also in faculty. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the only study I'm aware of where a higher percentage of men than women experienced imposter syndrome was a study conducted with college professors, which, I mean, a lot of men, period, feel like imposters. It's not just women, but also especially in a university setting. I mean, you're working alone. Mm-hmm. It's not a team effort in the sense that it might be in a corporate environment, for example. So that alone can make one feel like a fraud. The hoops you have to jump through, suddenly you're a scholar, right? You're in this whole other universe where you might not always know what the rules are, how decisions are made, you know, how tenure happens. You know, some people feel like the line keeps changing. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, that intense pressure to perform on this very scholarly level. And then within disciplines, there's hierarchies. You know, everyone knows in whether engineering or chemistry, everybody knows what's considered more prestigious and less prestigious, you know, in physics, et cetera. And some people get into academia because they like the rigorous debate. But it can also turn derisive. I mean, because the point is to kind of challenge other people's work. Mm-hmm. But if you're not kind of prepared for that, you know, it can be overwhelming to have your work constantly being challenged. Mm-hmm.
And then how about for students who are going through that process? In that case, again, I can see there's sort of this balance. You are part of a team. You're probably part of a lab or something like that where you're working on. But there is this focus on individual achievement or individual, you know, what have you specifically contributed, or how do you, what part do you play in writing this paper?
Right, so, absolutely. You know, and lots of pressure to publish, you know, the further along you go. I mean, just being a student, period, makes you more prone to feel like an imposter.
Why is that?
Well, you're in a situation where your knowledge and your abilities are being literally tested.
Right, like all the time.
Right, you know, and you signed up for it and you're paying for it, right? But it's very different than when you get out into the workforce. You know, I mean, we're all being tested in one way or another, but this is literally, you know, grades and measurements and standards, which is all based on intellect.
So, slight digression. You mentioned this one study that's found imposter syndrome more in men than women, had to do with university faculty. Mm-hmm. I think most of your work has been around imposter syndrome in women, but how does it affect men and women differently in our culture? Mm-hmm. And obviously our culture is very broad, but like in different situations and stuff.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and I started out looking at women because it's one of the very few psychological phenomena where psychologists thought initially was unique to one gender, i.e. women. And it was very quickly determined that a lot of men also feel this way as well. But I began before that became you know, readily apparent. There are a lot of men who painfully experience imposter syndrome. I spoke at Boeing and I walked into the room and it was 80% men. I mean, I literally thought I was in the wrong room. And it was very liberating for them to be able to, first of all, they were stunned to look around the room and see who else was there. You know, to have these men in suits that talk about the sheer terror they feel when they're handed a project that feels over their head, you know, is very liberating. I think it manifests itself a little differently in that, and of course, we're always generalizing, right? Because you can't say all men do this and all women do that. But as a group, men are more socialized to be more comfortable winging it and kind of making stuff up as they go along and acting tougher and braver and smarter than they maybe really feel internally, because you could get beat up, right? I mean, you have to, you know, with other boys, you have to, you know, project a certain kind of confidence and bravado. And that's not found in female culture. So, and winging it is an important element of life and just proceeding even though you don't have all the information, or throwing your hat into the ring for a job, even if you don't have all the criteria, and figuring, I'll figure it out when I get there. So those things serve men. The other big difference is that the research shows cross-culturally, internationally, as a group, girls and women are more likely to internalize failure, mistakes, and criticism. And boys and men, again, as a group, are more likely to externalize those things and blame factors outside of themselves. You know, the professor didn't give us enough time to study, the test was too tricky, the other team cheated.
As opposed to, I wasn't well enough prepared, or I didn't study enough, or I don't really understand the material.
Right, and there's implications for that, because we see, you know, young women are much more likely to drop out, especially in the STEM fields, if they fail a test or flunk a class. And I see more with boys. I mean, certainly there are some men who are very sensitive to criticism, you know, very sensitive. But there's others who see it as, they use it as fuel, you know, and it's like, well, I'll show them. And, or, you know, it sucks, I flunked that test, or, you know, that class, I'll go to summer school and I'll take it again. But far too often, I think girls and women, if someone says to you that report was inadequate or that paper was inadequate, what we hear is, I'm inadequate. You know, we let it mean more about who we are as a person, which is true from what I understand. I have to go back and look at the more latest research, but I was told at one point that when applying for a National Science Foundation grant, for example, you get research back, comments, and men are more likely to take the comments, massage the grant, resubmit it, and women are more likely, as a group, higher percentage, to just not resubmit.
Does that apply? I know it's always challenging in STEM fields and research with underrepresented minorities and more broadly than women.
Does this apply
in that?
Yeah, it does. It does. You know, I argue that a sense of belonging fosters confidence. So when you walk into a classroom or a meeting or a conference or a job site or the executive level in any organization, the more people who look like you, the more confident you feel. Conversely, the fewer people who look like you, it really can and does impact your level of confidence. We know, for example, that international students and workers test higher for imposter syndrome. There was a study in Canada where Medical residents who'd gotten their medical training outside of Canada, came to Canada for the residency, tested quite high for imposter feelings, which makes sense. I mean, you got the same pressures as everyone else, but you're doing it in a different culture or perhaps a second language. Mm-hmm. Anytime you belong to a group for whom there are stereotypes about competence, you're more susceptible.
Stereotype threat as well.
Yeah, but it could be based on age. I mean, certainly race and gender clearly come into play, but it also could be based on age, if you're the youngest person or if you are by far the oldest person. Now, I have to tell you something funny. I spoke at Facebook and I said, how many of you have felt like you're the oldest person in the group and you're being judged based on age, in a negative way, based on age? And the 30-year-olds were raising their hand. Yeah, but this is Facebook, right? That cracked me up. But even regional accent, you know, an accent that might sound working class, first generation students and professionals also have a higher propensity to feel like imposters. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you asked the question, Miriam, because I think it's important to not just psychologize this, but to put it into a social context, you know, because you know when you're sitting there, if you're the only person of color, or you're the only person with an accent, or you're the youngest, or you're the only woman, or one of few, and you say the dumb thing, you know, there's just much more awareness of that you represent, you know, that's a lot of pressure to have to represent. Or if you're the only person with a disability, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it cuts across many, many different groups.
Yeah. I'm curious, what's the kind of prevalence of this across populations? I mean, you know, we've just touched on like the sort of intersectionality issue and, you know, so many people have some element or will be in some
right.
scenario where they do feel like
yep.
the outsider, or they don't belong as much. But looking at, you know, very like 30,000 foot view kind of
yeah.
thing, how much does this crop up?
Well, quite a bit. I mean, but I think the thing that everyone, it's interesting to look at the different groups who might feel this way. But I also like to then say, okay, what do we all share in mm-hmm. common? Because that's where the solution lies. The,
right.
the other parts are good to be aware of, to put things in a social context. But what everybody who feels like an imposter shares in common is this. No one likes to fail. No one likes to make a mistake. No one likes to be criticized, have an off day, not know the answer, you know, have a flaw in their work. But when any of those things happen to people who feel like imposters, we experience shame. Because we feel like if I was really intelligent, capable, competent, qualified, I shouldn't, right? So if you fill in the blank, I should, I'd always, I'd never. You know, so this notion that I'd never have to struggle to master something, right? So there's all these scenarios around competence that evoke shame in people who feel like imposters.
So that transitions very nicely into the last thing I want to talk about, which is what do we do about this? So if you're someone who is experiencing these feelings, and even if, you know, intellectually maybe you know, okay, this is imposter syndrome, and
right.
I know that people around me really aren't 10 times better than I am or aren't really judging me as much as I think, what do you do when those... When
right.
that happens.
And you're right. We can intellectualize it, but then there's that feeling, mm-hmm. right, that we have. There's really three kind of core things. One is to normalize imposter feelings. You know, this is where I have to break it to people that they're not special.
A lot of people feel this way,
right? So maybe, you know, there's some really good reasons why you might have these feelings. Doesn't mean they're good or positive. And that's, you know, in my book, I initially have a section that says, well, maybe it's not all bad. You know, there's some parts to it that are good. I've changed my thinking since I published the book. I now look at it like, yeah, there's the humility and all that. But I think we can have that without the shame of feeling like an imposter.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd rather get rid of imposter feelings, you know, and you can still keep the humility.
Mm-hmm.
One thing you can't do is share your way out of imposter syndrome.
Mm.
And I say that because there are psychologists who suggest if you just keep talking about it, the better you'll feel. And I don't know about you, but you know, when I talk about how fat I feel, like I never feel any thinner, oddly. You know? It doesn't help. So yes, talk about it, but in a normalizing way. I'd love to see students, I'd love to see faculty, I'd love to see folks in the workplace say, oh yeah, that imposter thing, oh, that's really normal. And I'd love to see them talk about their imposter feelings, because it would rock someone's world to have this professor that you admire, you go, oh, absolutely, oh yes, many people feel that way, it's perfectly normal. So normalizing it, I think, is really important, especially since, you know, 70% of achievers have these feelings. The second thing is to reframe. And what I mean by that is that people who don't feel like imposters are no more intelligent or capable or competent than you and I. The only difference between them and us is they think different thoughts. That's it. So when we can become familiar with what is that thought pattern that's going through my head when I'm having an imposter moment, And then to be able to pause and reframe it and go, how would a non-imposter frame this? Because non-imposters think differently about failure, mistakes, criticism. They think differently about competence, and they think differently about fear. Mm-hmm. I was telling some folks this morning, I interviewed this entrepreneur, and he said, well, let me begin by talking about my three biggest mistakes, because that's where I learn the most. That's the way non-imposters think. They don't feel shame around failure. I mean, let me be clear. If you fail or you don't do as well as you wish you had, you can be disappointed. They are disappointed, but they don't feel shame. The only time you'd feel shame is if you really didn't give it your best shot. But they look at things like even criticism. You know, it wounds imposters because it becomes kind of proof of our ineptness, right? But they would be more likely, if someone came up to you after a presentation and said, that was really great, a non-imposter would say, thank you so much. What's one thing I could have done better? Right? Or I've had people interview me and say, what would you say to the student who shows up at this, you know, Harvard or something, and they're so intimidated because everyone is so brilliant? And I'd say, well, a non-imposter would say the exact same thing, but they'd say it like this: wow, everyone is so brilliant here. I am going to learn so much. Yeah. You know, they see themselves as a work in progress. They don't expect themselves to know all the answers. Unlike this graduate student at Stanford who said, I feel like I should already know what I came here to learn. Huh. Right? And when you say it out loud, you know it's like crazy talk,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Right. Yeah. And that's why it is important to become aware of what is that little crazy voice in our head that has these unrealistic, unsustainable expectations for ourselves. And then to be able to say, well, aren't I entitled to make a mistake or to have an off day or be wrong or, you know, get them next time. And they don't expect themselves to know everything. Mm-hmm. They don't expect everything to come quickly and easily. And imposters often beat themselves up if there's any struggle to master a subject, a concept, a skill set. You know, they're all about kind of ease and speed. They would feel shame asking for help. A non-imposter, they would think, the smartest thing I can do right now is walk across the hall and ask this person or pick up the phone and, you know, call my colleague and pick their brain, because they don't see shame in asking for help. They think that's wise.
Great. So normalizing.
Yeah, reframing. And then to keep going regardless of how you feel.
Don't let it stop you.
Don't let it stop you. But also, the reality is feelings are the last to change. You know, what people want is to read my book or walk into, you know, one of my workshops or my talks feeling like an imposter and walk out not feeling like an imposter. And that's not how it works, because feelings are the last to change. You have to change how you think, even though you don't believe the new thoughts. I want to be really clear. You do not believe the new thoughts, right?
Right.
So, as you know, because the body doesn't know the difference between fear and excitement. You know, sweaty palms, nervous stomach. So you have to keep saying to yourself as you walk up to the podium or into the interview or your, you know, faculty advisor's office, I'm excited, right? I'm excited. You don't believe it, but that's okay. You have to keep giving yourself that message. And it's important, because a lot of people don't step up their game. They don't challenge themselves because they're waiting to feel more confident. And that's not how it works. You have to do the thing that you have to stretch and be uncomfortable. And then realize, no matter what happens, that you gave it your best shot, like kind of win or lose, learn from both. And then after a while, the confidence will catch up. So it's thoughts, behaviors, and then feelings.
So thinking about, again, coming back around to sort of our scientific community perspective, what are things that people can do? So normalizing, obviously, is sort of a community activity where mm-hmm. we talk about these things, and it's not this mysterious, shameful kind of internal thing.
Yep.
Are there other things that you see on a more sort of systemic or cultural level?
Yeah,
that,
absolutely.
That can shift?
I mean, I it's always a surprise to me that this is not kind of in the student handbook, or mm-hmm. it's not part of resident RA training in the dorms, right? Even on the undergraduate mm-hmm. level. There are some institutions now that are bringing students together on the first day, particularly graduate students. And instead of the old model, which was look to your left, look to your right, you know, half of you won't be here next year, like great way to start your academic career.
Yeah.
You know, they're bringing folks together and saying, you know, some of you are sitting here thinking you might not deserve to be here. We're here to tell you that you do. But I'd like them to go another step and really help people think like non-imposters. You could do that. You could have posters around. You could, you know, there's cultural ways to send messages. So it could be a series of posters in the hall of prestigious faculty with a paragraph about their best failure. There was actually a Princeton, if your listeners Google Princeton professor failure CV,
okay,
they'll find a guy who got the idea from a woman mm-hmm. from University of Edinburgh, I think, who wrote about learning more from failures than from successes. So he put together a CV of all the grants he didn't get, the jobs he didn't get, the rejections he got along the way. And it was like mind-blowing to people, which is scary that that is so mind-blowing. But he was trying to let them know it's not this straight line, this ascension, one big success story. It's a series of ups and downs and lows and highs. And he didn't want people to give up when they hit the inevitable wall. Like, okay, that didn't work. Now what?
That's great. I'll see if we can find that and link to it on our little podcast page.
On a university level, it could be one of the very first exercises in a class is something that everyone is going to fail at. It's like intentionally designed for failure, and then go, okay, stop. And to examine what was going through their head, that experience of failing, and what do we learn from it? So in other words, how do you help people fail without feeling like failures?
And that's a huge, I think that is something that's very resonant to the scientific community, because the whole process of science is about
failure analysis.
That's right. We don't know the answers.
Right.
That's why we're doing our experiments. That's why we're trying to come up with new hypotheses and all that kind of stuff. And if everything went exactly as predicted, we'd be doing something wrong. You know, that's not how the process is supposed to work.
Yeah.
But I think that gets lost sometimes in the way people think about their own kind of academic training. Yeah, we know that about the scientific method, but I should still be doing everything perfectly.
Yeah. It's interesting how that doesn't translate to the individual level.
Yeah. And I just thought of one other thing I was going to ask. So you mentioned yourself having experienced this.
Definitely.
Obviously, it's a spectrum, as with many things, of the degree to which you're feeling it. Do you feel like, for you, it's improved over time?
It's definitely improved, and it's because I'm thinking differently. But here's the difference. My goal is not for people to never feel like an imposter again. I mean, if that happens, great. The goal is to have the tools and the insight and an alternative to thinking so that when you have an imposter moment, you can talk yourself down faster. So that it's either an imposter moment or maybe a 24-hour news cycle of feeling, you know, crushed and disappointed, but then you, you know, talk yourself using non-imposter think.
Have the tools to
as a tool to get yourself out of it. I'll give you a perfect example. I did a kind of a TED Talk, New York City idea search, and chosen out of hundreds of people, there was 11 of us who did it. It was the most stressful thing I've ever done. You know, I feel pretty confident speaking. My body felt disengaged from my head. I mean, the bright lights and, you know, I give myself a B+, and I worked hundreds of hours on that 6 minutes, writing it and then practicing it. I gave myself a B+. I wanted an A+, right? So I was crushingly disappointed for like 24 hours. It really was 24 hours. And then I could think, okay, you know, you did your best. You did everything you could. It is what it is. What I learned from it. Here's the things I'm still going to get out of this experience. You know, and I was able to reframe it and put it in perspective. And life went on.
Right. That's a perfect illustration. Wonderful. Well, anything else you think we should, have I forgotten to ask about or anything else?
You know, the only thing I would say is for people to realize that it's not all about you. That everyone loses when bright people play small. So if you can't kind of stretch yourself, you know, for yourself, think about the contribution, big or small. We all have gifts that the world deserves to have put out there in the world.
That's a great note to end on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you taking the time.
And that's it for this episode of the Sustainable Nano Podcast. Thank you so much to Dr. Valerie Young again for doing the interview with us. Thank you to the University of Minnesota Chemistry Chapter of Women in Science and Engineering for arranging Dr. Young's visit. Thanks, as always, to the National Science Foundation, which provides funding for the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, the producer of this podcast. As always, we have our disclaimer that the opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily those of the National Science Foundation. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners. You can interact with us on social media. We are at Sustainable Nano, all one word, on both Twitter and Facebook. If you want more material, you can go to our Sustainable Nano blog at sustainable-nano.com. And you can find all of our previous podcast episodes at podcast.sustainable-nano.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. So let us know what you think. What do you want to hear? What do you like? What do you not like? We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks again for listening, and we'll be back in a couple weeks with our next episode.